This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to The Waves, Slate's podcast about gender, feminism, and the grim side of happily ever after. Every episode of The Waves, you get a new feminist to talk about the thing we can't get off our minds. And today you've got me, Laura Miller, a books and culture columnist for Slate. One of the things we're going to be talking about is fairy tales. Fairy tales, like myths, are the oldest form of human storytelling, and they have always been closely linked to women. The great 19th century collectors of fairy tales like the Brothers Grimm presented them as stories for children, stories passed on by grandmothers and nursemaids and aunties. But today, folklorists believe that traditional stories like these were meant for a mixed audience of adults and children. The use of fairy tales to entertain and teach is something that has endured throughout the ages, and there's a reason we keep getting big screen adaptations of stories like Cinderella and Beauty and the Beast. It's not just because they've become Disney properties. So what is it about this type of story that makes us keep coming back? What do the new iterations have to say about how we view women? Our guest today is Kelly Link, the author of the new story collection, White Cat, Black Dog, seven stories, each based on a particular fairy tale. I've been a huge fan of Kelly's since reading her very first short story collection, Stranger Things Happen, all the way back in 2001. And I adore the way she mixes myth, everyday life, and pop culture to create something entirely new. When we get back from the break, Kelly is going to join me from her farmhouse in Massachusetts to talk about White Cat, Black Dog, and the fairy tales that inspired it. Stay with us. Hey, Wave listeners, if you're loving the show and want to hear more, subscribe to our feed. New episodes come out every Thursday morning. While you're there, check out our other episodes, too. Recently, we've been talking about how movies have become sexless and the benefits of a dull marriage and so much more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to The Waves. I'm joined by Kelly Link today. Kelly, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And I am thrilled to be able to talk to you about your new book, White Cat, Black Dog. I want to start with kind of the big picture, because I have been just a fan of your work for so long. I think there's a story in your first collection, Stranger Things Happen, that epitomizes the way that you work with, in a way that blends ancient myths and popular culture to create stories that speak to these big eternal themes while also being funny and relatable. And it's called The Girl Detective. And we all know who that is because for some of us, Nancy Drew is just as iconic a figure as Cinderella or, I don't know, Orpheus. And she travels to the underworld in search of her mother, this girl detective. And you have another story in that collection, Travels with the Snow Queen, that is based on the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. So, well, this new book is kind of deliberately and systematically based on fairy tales. You've always incorporated them into your work. And I'm just sort of curious, when you picked a particular fairy tale, were you sometimes saying, oh, I want to tell this story, and what fairy tale does it relate to? Or did you start with the fairy tale? Like, how did you choose the particular fairy tales?
For the most part, I had a story that I wanted to tell. There are a couple of stories where I began with the fairy tale and then thought about what I could do with do with that story. But mostly the stories began with a character or with a kind of image that I knew I wanted the story to move towards. And then I would begin to think about possible fairy tales that I could use to hang that image on or to insert that character into, and then to think about whether I wanted it to be a very close retelling or if I wanted to camouflage or make the fairy tale as invisible as possible.
An interesting thing about fairy tale inspired short fiction is that it seems to be most popular with women writers. And, you know, there's often the attempt to sort of retell the fairy tale from a perspective that might seem more feminist, although arguably they aren't necessarily non-feminist, if you know what I mean. Was there something particular you're trying to do with these, you know, like with Angela Carter's famous collection, The Bloody Chamber? She was often trying to break open an established story and take it someplace totally different. But that might have seemed more important back in the 70s when she was doing that than it does to you now. I'm just sort of curious if there was a particular way that you approached the original material, like a particular goal.
That is a very interesting question. I love Angela Carter. I actually have a copy of the Old Wives fairy tale book in front of me because I was looking at that introduction again. I didn't want to do something that would feel duplicative of work that she'd already done. What I wanted for myself in this was to deliberately engage out in the open with the kind of work that I am always engaged with anyway. I'm not even sure that to say it borrows the framework is correct, but it comes from, it sort of wells up from a couple of sources. Ghost stories is a big one, but fairy tales is the other big one. And it seemed as if it would be not just a pleasurable experiment, but it would change in some way the way that I worked if I began with a statement to myself in the subtitle that here is one of the sources for the story that I'm going to be writing. Actually, when I say that, I think the story that I'm going to be telling, because fairy tales often feel more told than they feel written. And that also was sort of a useful framework for myself to allow myself to feel as if I was telling something rather than writing something.
That's so interesting, because I think that really the roots of the fairy tale are in the oral tradition. And while people think of them as being stories that grandmothers told children, you know, adults told children, lots of folklorists believe that they were stories that women swapped with each other while they were doing work with their hands, you know, sewing or churning or something like that. How is a story that is told different from a story that's written? And do you feel like there's some kind of gender connection there?
There may be. And part of it is, I think that the two modes, telling and writing, have different kinds of authority attached to them. I kind of crave the authority of the storytelling voice that tells, that has a conversational aspect to it, that feels maybe a little bit more personal, that to me there is a kind of strength there that allows me, I guess, a voice. And if I am writing, there is something interior to the idea of writing. It's almost as if you're pulling something out of the interior. Whereas if I'm telling, I already imagine a kind of audience for myself. I imagine that there is slightly more back and forth, but it also is closer to, I think, the kind of relationship that I like to imagine, that as you're saying, that it is a story told in company, that the audience maybe is commenting back. You know, maybe that idea, especially of telling, is gendered. That when I imagine telling, I'm not just imagining my voice. I'm imagining a kind of a conversational telling.
And the stories also come from kind of a collective place sometimes, too. Well, I mean, the fairy tales obviously do.
Everyone in their head has a version of the most common fairy tales. And there are going to be aspects of that fairy tale inside your head that are personal. The things that feel important about it, they may be the same things that other people also find important. But I think that there's something deeply personal about how we imagine a fairy tale pattern and when we're thinking about it for ourselves.
Right. Well, one of the patterns that you've used more than once is the story of someone who loses their beloved and who has to travel to all of these outrageous places and endure all of these trials and enlist the help of this kind of animal assistance and to find that loved one who's been stolen away, that beloved who has been stolen away. I was fascinated that you, in this new book, you have a story where half of a gay couple does that. It turns out that his husband he had stolen his husband from the Queen of Hell, and she took him back. And then you also had Travels with the Snow Queen, which is a similar concept. There's this kind of supernatural force that has taken the beloved away. And I guess this probably also has its roots in the Cupid and Psyche myth from Greek mythology. And I'm wondering what attracts you to that particular motif.
Often I think what I like about it are the accessories. I like the idea of somebody going on a long quest. I really love the idea of the animal helper, or the wind who comes and helps. But also I think I love a romantic comedy. I love a story about somebody who goes and does a lot of very hard work on behalf of someone that they love. I do love in East of the Sun, West of the Moon that there's a happy ending there. And I realized that I took this premise and I made something out of it that is not entirely happy. The story kind of ends with a question, but I at least got to spend time with this sort of romantic comedy.
Hey Waves listeners, it's Shayna Roth. Your Slate Plus segment this week is another episode of our weekly And Just Like That recap. Every week from now until the end of August, I'll be taking over your weekly Plus segment to talk about season 2 of the Sex and the City sequel series with your favorite Slatesters like Daisy Rosario, Heather Schwedell, Luke Winkie, and more. If you're not currently a Slate Plus member, you can sign up now by going to slate.com/thewavesplus to get bonus content for The Waves, along with all of the other Slate podcasts. You'll also get unlimited access to the Slate site. No hitting that pesky paywall. Go to slate.com/thewavesplus to learn more and sign up now. slate.com/thewavesplus.
Welcome back to The Waves. My guest today is Kelly Link, author of the new fairy tale inspired short story collection, White Cat, Black Dog. One of the things people really want from fairy tales is like a moral, right? Like that's often like they're supposed to teach a lesson or deliver some kind of rule of thumb for life. I don't get the impression that that's something that you particularly want to do or feel empowered to do.
When you say that people want a moral from fairy tales, I think, oh no. And I think that there are some very general, hard to argue with pieces of advice often in fairy tales, such as treat animals well, be polite to old ladies.
That's a really important
you
one.
Know. But to strike out and sort of follow the path that seems open to you. But I don't particularly think about morals when I think of fairy tales. What I think of is adventure or you know, large events befalling people, which does feel true to life, except it's more compressed in a fairy tale. Large things sort of keep on happening until the story is over, after which point you kind of hope that large events don't befall those characters in the future. One of the things that I like about fairy tales is they are often about people who are trying their best, who are in fact pretty well behaved, but who also are pretty brave in terms of doing the right thing. And maybe that is moral, the idea that you know, you should speak up when there is injustice, or you should sort of listen to good advice, but sort of disregard people who are ill-intentioned. Maybe there is something moral in that. I don't know why I'm so suspicious of the idea of morals.
I think when people think about fairy tales as offering some kind of model, they often think of the happy ending. Like people say, I want my fairy tale ending. And then when you actually think about it, you think, well, most fairy tales are actually, it's a happy ending just because of where they choose to end it, you know?
And then
when the new story starts up again, it's always about the king, you know, after the wedding or whatever, it's always about the king and queen who can't have kids, who have to do this or that. You know, it's kind of arbitrary.
I think the idea of a happy ending is often things have been restored. Maybe the king has changed. Maybe there's a new king instead of the old. Maybe the marriage is beginning. But there's the idea of a kind of balance being restored. The changes are small ones. I think that if I have a quarrel with fairy tales, it's that there's no large institutional change. You know, that small happiness is possible, or happiness within an established framework is possible. But the poor people are still going to be poor on the whole. It's just that somebody may have gotten to move up.
So let's talk a little bit about your life as a writer. You live in a farmhouse in Massachusetts, and you have dogs, and you have chickens, and you have an excellent husband named Gavin and a daughter. And you and Gavin have been running a small publishing house and putting out the kinds of books that you love, including your own books, for a couple of decades now. And you even own a bookstore in East Hampton called Book Moon that people should check out if they're ever in the area. And just listening to all of this, I think, oh, this sounds like somebody's fantasy of the writer's life. And but as someone who recently moved to a small town, I also know that sometimes when you want to get away from it all, what you have to sacrifice is sort of the community of other writers. Not always, but a lot of the time, you know, like the idea of getting away from it all, sometimes some of the all is actually kind of a good thing. But you, I know, often meet with two fellow writers, Cassandra Clare and Holly Black, who are mostly known for writing YA fantasy and really hugely popular work. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about this. I mean, this is, again, part of your whole charmed life thing, where you get to hang out with these other writers as well as being able to get away with it all. But can you tell me what those friendships are like and how they affect your work? And do you feel like Cassie and Holly have had a big effect on your work? I mean, has having that particular community changed your work, do you think?
I am sure that it has, in the sense that we talk through with each other the projects that we are working on. And I think that one of the earliest things that I learned was that talking through a project for me did not distort that project. It didn't mean that I was no longer to access the things about it that made it interesting. You know, we were talking about fairy tales and the idea of community and gossip. And for me, it felt like that it was, that there is the collective approach to the things that I am most interested in, which are not just, you know, the things that I'm writing about, but the question of how best to work as a writer, what it means to have a career as a writer, how genre operates. What are the pieces of a story pattern that feel most essential, and which pieces of a story pattern are variable, that working and talking with two other writers has made it possible to have discussions about this, and that my point of view, which is necessarily limited because I'm only one person, having access to two other patterns of thought about how storytelling can work is enormously enriching for me. And I really love being in an environment where if I write a scene and it feels stale to me, or it feels as if it doesn't quite have the quality that I want, being able to pass it across the table to another writer and say, will you take a look at this? And then maybe we can talk about it. That there's an editorial aspect to the community.
You get that sort of, not instant feedback, but it is like one of the things about being an oral storyteller is you can tell when you're losing your audience, you know, and and when they're, you know, leaning forward and when they're sort of slumping back, and it's great to just have that group of other storytellers there to sort of just get a quick read on it if you're worried that you're entering into the slumping back part. And I also just have to wonder, you know, for many years, you have a novel coming out in about a year, and, you know, you've only published short stories before. And I always had the impression that you just felt the novel wasn't a congenial form to you, which I think is totally fine because your short stories are fantastic. But I'm also wondering if maybe they, you know, Cassie and Holly helped you do this thing, which maybe or convinced you that it was worth doing, or, you know, they might have played a role in helping you, because I know writing that novel was grueling for you.
It was. And absolutely. When I sold the previous collection, Get in Trouble, to Random House, Holly Black said to me, you should also sell them a novel, because if you don't sell them a novel and write it deliberately, you will write it accidentally. And that felt true. She pointed out that my short stories were getting longer and longer, and that I seemed to be tempted by the deeper water of the novel. And I will agree with you that I don't find the novel form congenial, but I did find it interesting. And even before setting down to write it, the idea of working on a novel seemed interesting because it would be something new. And I absolutely think, because I have been writing with them for years now, for well over a decade, I have workshopped any number of novels with them. I've sat with them while they are in agony, you know, writing their novels. It's not that it seemed like it would be fun, but it did seem possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you to Cassie and Holly for that. But alas, that is all that we have time for today. I want to thank Kelly Link so much for coming to The Waves to talk about her wonderful new book, White Cat, Black Dog.
Thank you so much.
That's our show this week. The Waves is produced by Shayna Roth. Daisy Rosario is Senior Supervising Producer. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio. We'd love to hear from you, so email us at thewaves@slate.com. And The Waves will be back next week. Different host, different topic, same time and place.
Hey, Waves listeners, just a heads up, this segment contains spoilers for And Just Like That, Episode 3. Hey, Waves listeners, it's Shayna Roth. Every week, we're posting a recap of the Sex and the City sequel, And Just Like That, exclusively for Slate Plus members. Here's a little bit of what Slate writer Luke Winky and I had to say about Episode 3. What are this show's politics? Last episode, there was like a weird comment about Democrats while Carrie was at a store with Charlotte.
Breathe. Unknown caller. Better not be the Democrats again.
This episode, you have a guy wearing a tie-dye mask and a like N95 mask underneath that. And that guy apparently has BO, which, I mean, didn't people smell bad jokes die like 10 years ago? That was weird. And then nobody cares when a guy is full-blown shoving jewelry in his pockets, but then Carrie yells out, "I have COVID," and suddenly everyone loses their minds. What's he doing? What the fuck is this guy doing? His cater waiter is stealing my shit. Security, help! Somebody do something!
I have COVID!
Security, someone! This guy is stealing my stuff! Somebody help me! And then, as you mentioned, you have this scene in the school where all of these middle-aged women are talking about being on this MILF list, and then a kid walks out, a minor. He's in high school, and they're all, like, drooling.
You that bitch. You that bitch.
Ooh. Ooh, is that Milo H?
H for hot.
Why do I feel like Blanche DuBois?
Like, it's all so bad, and it felt very regressive.
Yeah, yeah. I actually, like, I'm glad you brought this up. I feel like my parents are good, solid Democrat voters. You know, I've been around a lot of people of this age bracket that, you know, skew left. I kind of notice in them what I notice in the show, where, like, there's, like, a real desire to, like, live by the right code of ethics, to be, like, quote-unquote woke. And you obviously see that with how diverse the cast has gotten and just how they're just not, I mean, some of those old Sex and the City episodes have not aged well, and they've really tried to make an effort to not atone for that, or at least be aware of it, you know, to kind of, you know, that obviously the show has dealt with, you know, cancel culture, things like that. But I do feel like people that demographic, even if they want to demonstrate that or want to live by that, there is still a part of them that feels maybe a little bit resentful, or like a little, maybe feels that all this stuff might be the slightest bit stupid, or like that people might be overreacting a little bit, or and a little bit of exhaustion, which I don't think that in itself is necessarily, like, you know, you're not evil for feeling that way necessarily. But I do kind of notice that in this show. It's a show where people of this age demographic are trying to engage with this stuff and kind of live by it. But there has to be a voice somewhere in their head that are still seem a little bit exasperated by it. Does that make sense?
It does. And it's weird because I could almost forgive the we're grown women and we're going to go, ooh, over a cute teenager almost. But then you couple that in the same episode where a sound guy goes fishing down the shirt of Nia Wallace when her mic slips while they're recording a documentary.
I think my mic slipped down.
Oh, Brian.
Yeah, I'm on it.
I'm sorry.
I'll get that for you.
It's fine.
Part of my reach. I just got to.
Oh, yeah, sure. Of course, yeah. Oh. Shouldn't you buy me dinner first?
You know what? I really think we got it, and we're running over, so I think we can just wrap it up.
Copy, if you mind. Oh, okay. Were you serious about that dinner?
I have been on documentary crews, and there's no world in which a man would just stick his hand down a woman's shirt. I don't care where her mic is located. And then he says, yeah, I'd love to take you out. And she's into it. This is not great, guys.
Yeah, it was a little tough. So it was one thing in the beginning where, like, okay, maybe I can suspend my disbelief that this is the only recourse here, that he just has to kind of shove his hand down her shirt. But then, like, is like, are you serious about that date? Like, that part's like, okay, if this was attempting to be, like, you know, just a maybe a little fraught, but still a meet cute of, like, oh, this is awkward. You know, hey, we're stuck on this desert island together. What else is there? What are those? That's fine. That part was a little odd. I don't know if there's a reckoning or, like, coming, or if they're going to try to engage with this a little bit more. But right now, this is a world where the best place to meet a hot divorcee in their 50s and 40s is to do it at work.
I know. I really, for her, I want them to bring back the guy in the bar from, I think it was episode one or two, who used to be
hot.
On CSI.
He was hotter than the other guy.
Right? Bring him back.
He has to come back. I would be shocked if he's gone.
I hope so. They had some real chemistry. I liked it.
If you want to hear the whole conversation and get all the weekly episodes of our And Just Like That recap, head on over to slate.com/thewavesplus to become a Slate Plus member today. slate.com/thewavesplus.